From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. You can do that right now. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, Satan-worshipping pedophiles run the deep state and the press. The deadly fires on the West Coast were set by Antifa members. And Mike Pence is coming to our fundraiser in Montana. Now, of the crazy claims made by the conspiracy theorist QAnon, only the last one was true. But once public attention fell on plans for the vice president to cozy up with these extremists, there was a sudden scheduling conflict. Gregory Stanton of Genocide Watch has written in detail about the origins of much of QAnon's most resonant rhetoric. In early 1900s, Russian anti-Semitic propaganda was instrumental in the birth of the German Nazi Party. While the FBI has linked the movement to acts of domestic terrorism, Donald Trump has amplified QAnon-related tweets and Twitter accounts at least 216 times. Meanwhile, a new poll from Pew Research Center shows people in U.S. allied nations around the world now trust Russian strongman Vladimir Putin and Chinese president for life Xi Jinping more than they trust Donald Trump. German approval for the U.S. president shockingly has fallen from 86% in 2016 to just 10% today. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
In an election year like no other, we're called upon to act. People of faith and faith values don't belong to any one party or politician. This year, I'm voting for housing and economic justice. Your vote, your values.
Amidst all the turmoil and tribulation facing our nation and the world, the November 3rd election continues to inch closer. To help ensure voters stay both engaged and focused, Interfaith Alliance is launching a series of messages under the banner, Your Vote, Your Values. On this week's show, we'll get the latest from Alliance Director of Policy, Catherine Joseph.
Rosh Hashanah comes in, it's a new year, and you're supposed to. It's a practice designed to help you experience a sense of hope and possibility that you can be reborn as a human being and you can let go of much of what has distorted you.
The Jewish New Year celebration of Rosh Hashanah began on Friday evening. I'm looking forward to welcoming Rabbi Irwin Kula, president of CLOUL, to discuss unprecedented challenges and new beginnings. But first,
white evangelical Christians are a key part of the Republican coalition and have stuck with the president through a series of scandals.
Do you care if your president had an affair before he was president?
No.
I believe he's president of the United States for a reason. I think God put him there.
Tons of attention gets heaped on the conservative white Protestant evangelicals who turned out in such incredible numbers to vote for Donald Trump, and who continue to pledge their fealty to him today. But the Catholic vote seems harder to quantify and to report on, at least in the mainstream press. Dr. Mark J. Rozelle, he's an editor of the timely 2018 book titled Catholics and U.S. Politics After the 2016 Elections, Understanding the Swing Vote. And his recent article headlined, Catholics, Not Evangelicals, Will Make or Break Trump, appeared in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Mark, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
You write that economic progress and opposition to abortion drive today's white Catholic vote toward the Republicans. Talk about that, please, if you would.
Sure. So for my parents' generation, Catholic identity was very critical to their decision to support, for example, John F. Kennedy for the presidency in 1960. Identity is not really all that important today for Catholics. You can look at, for example, John Kerry, Catholic, who lost the Catholic vote to Methodist George Bush in 2004. And so there really has been a significant change over time, generationally, in how Catholics view their loyalties politically. Up until the 1970s, the Catholic vote was part of the old New Deal Democratic coalition that voted heavily Democrat time and again. But with the rise of the abortion issue in the 1970s, with the Roe decision, of course, and then a cultural change as well that was already taking place. So for my parents' generation, people who came to this country, moved to the inner cities, joined labor unions, American Catholics were Democrats. But as their children and grandchildren started to attain economic success, moved to the suburbs, they opened up more to the Republican Party over time. And that's especially so among white Catholics. And we've seen, beginning in the 1980s, a shifting of the political loyalties of white Catholics to become more bipartisan, more open to voting Republican, and then over time increasingly becoming Republican, to the point where today the white Catholic vote leans strongly Republican, and the minority Catholic voters, particularly Latinos, lean heavily Democratic.
Mm. You see Catholic voters as determinant in the three swing states that put Trump in the White House. Has enough changed in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin since 2016, either demographically or economically, to significantly alter the odds for re-election there?
So the polling data I have seen suggests that there has been some positive movement among white Catholics toward Joe Biden. Not substantially so, but maybe enough to make a significant difference. So as you point out, it was only 107,000 vote difference in those three states combined that delivered the election in the Electoral College to Donald Trump in 2016. And the Catholic component was a significant portion of that, particularly white Catholics. And so just looking at the voting data, you know, Hillary Clinton received significantly fewer white Catholic votes, about 10% fewer than Barack Obama had in 2008 and 2012. And that was very significant. Now, there is some recent data showing that there has been some drop-off in positivity ratings for Donald Trump among white Catholics. That could be significant this year. Demographically, I don't think there's been too much of a change. The other big disappointment, by the way, for Democrats in 2016 for Hillary Clinton's campaign was the predicted Latino surge that everybody talked about never happened. So Latino voting actually was down several percentage points in 2016 over what it had been in 2012. And it was about 10% more positive to the Republicans, to Trump, than it had been for Mitt Romney. And that was quite a shock. And some have suggested that some core social issues that appeal to more conservative Catholics, and that would include some Latinos, not just white Catholics, may have been a driving force there for Trump in 2016 to make that difference.
You write that white Catholic support for Trump is eroding. If that is the way it is, what do you see influencing that shift the most?
Right. So eroding might be a bit stronger than I would put it at this point. I think it's been somewhat declining. And even if it declines only at the margins, given the closeness of the vote in the critical Great Lakes states that have substantial Catholic populations and were critical in 2016, that would be very important. So, for example, some of the appeal that Donald Trump had to white Catholic voters, I am sure, was more economic-based than faith-based. He talked about bringing back the manufacturing sector, for example, to those states and reviving their economies. So one reason that there has been some decline, I am sure, in support among white Catholics for Trump in those critical states is the fact that he has not been able to bring back those sectors of the economy in any substantial way. And I think that's weighed significantly on some of those voters who were basically sold the promise that he was going to bring back manufacturing jobs and bring back the economies of those parts of the country that were suffering as a result of globalization.
Similar to the way American evangelicals are more likely to blindly support all pro-Israel policies than many American Jews, white U.S. Catholics are polling almost 20 points in favor of Donald Trump and against Joe Biden, the lifelong Catholic. How do you analyze these trends?
Right. So for many of the white Catholics, as I was pointing out before, the shifting in political loyalties away from being part of the old New Deal coalition and automatically voting Democrat beginning in the 1970s and 80s had to do with the so-called life issues. And so the abortion issue pulled away many religious Catholics from the Democratic Party when the party was perceived as too strongly pro-abortion rights. And at that point, I think many white Catholics started to question their past political loyalty to the Democratic Party. And also, as I pointed out before, the generational change, right, that, our grandparents may have come from the old country and moved to the inner cities and joined labor unions and voted automatically Democratic, but their grandchildren look at the world differently. You know, they've had higher education, achieved economic success. Until recent years, that generally translated into Republican support, a little less so today. But I think that is an important component of that.
So it's no longer primarily denominational teachings or shared membership that are driving seemingly faith-based voters. Are there historical precedents for this?
Yeah, there are. And in response to your question there, identity is just not as important as it used to be. So Donald Trump can win 81% of white evangelicals, even though he mangled important, lines from the Bible in his speech at Liberty University, and he has nothing in his personal background that at all is compatible with white evangelical voters, particularly in the Deep South in the United States. But it really comes down to policy more than anything else. So in doing my research on the intersection of religion and politics, I've interviewed a lot of leaders in the evangelical movement and those who led the Catholics for Trump endeavor back in 2016. And they will tell you that Trump's promises that he made in the campaign on policy issues and especially on appointments to the federal courts and more than anything, the Supreme Court were what sealed the deal. That they had been frustrated by having been told by past Republican Party nominees for public offices that they supported the social issues agenda of religious conservatives, only to find that when successfully elected to office, the social issues got put to the back burner. But what they heard from Donald Trump was somebody who was not part of the Republican establishment, wasn't going to wait on the social issues, was going to deliver what he promised. And now they say, look at what he has done. Look at what he did on Israel. Look at what he's doing on social issues. Look at his appointments. So from their standpoint, and I'm talking about religious conservatives, the evangelicals as well as conservative white Catholics, this is a president who delivers on the policy issues that make a real difference to millions of people. And that's what matters more than identity.
And when you say identity, are you talking about the way in which the president talks, the many times in which people say he's not telling the truth? All of that just gets set aside?
It does get set aside. And, you know, we can have a long conversation about that and, you know, what that means for our politics. I find it extremely discouraging, right? And I found it very discouraging in 2016 that personal character didn't seem to matter to the religious conservative voters, who, by the way, during the Clinton impeachment scandal, by about a 3-to-1 margin in public opinion surveys, said that personal, ethical, moral character were critical to whether someone deserves a position in public life and having public trust in a position such as the presidency. And those numbers have completely flipped in the Trump era. The same polls asking the same questions show that among those who support Donald Trump in the white evangelical, white Catholic communities, personal character is not considered as important. So it's very situational, I have to say. It's not based on any sort of broader ethical, moral principles that are applied consistently across political parties or whoever happens to hold political office. You know, it's the old tribalism argument, right? It's, you know, whose side are you on? And I'm going to take the position that supports my person, which, you know, whichever position that happens to be.
What about Hispanic Catholics, a demographic that the Biden-Harris campaign is counting on? Where is that going?
Right. Well, I think they need to do a lot more outreach to Catholic voters in critical states in the Electoral College, both white Catholics and Latino Catholics. They need to make a much better showing among white Catholics than Hillary Clinton did in 2016. I don't see a lot of activity there in the Biden campaign. Maybe I'm missing it, but it doesn't seem to be a very prominent part of the campaign now. And Latino Catholics, importantly, can't be taken for granted. And I think maybe a little bit of that happened in 2016. Everybody assumed, many of the smart analysts, right, based on some of the comments that Donald Trump had made about immigrants and Mexicans and the like, you know, the terrible things he had said, that there was going to be a Latino surge, and he was going to get overwhelmed by the Latino vote. Well, the Latino vote was down several percentage points from what it had been in 2012, and it was slightly more positive to Trump than it had been to Romney. I mean, it was three-quarters for Obama in 2012. It was about two-thirds for Clinton in 2016, the Latino vote. But that several percentage point loss in support among Latinos for Clinton over what Obama had achieved, plus the drop in turnout among Latinos, was devastating to her campaign. So they need to do a lot there, and they need to do a lot of outreach and take those votes very seriously.
Are there other trends or themes that you're keeping an eye on in the last weeks before the election? What are you looking at?
Wow. So I'm looking at the key states, of course, in the Electoral College and ignoring the national public opinion polls that led everybody in the wrong direction 4 years ago in terms of analyzing the state of the race and the direction where it was going. I think the presidential debates are going to be especially important in this cycle. President Trump is trying to paint a picture of Joe Biden as not up to the job to the presidency, not only, you know, being whatever, low energy, whatever phrase he uses, sleepy, but even cerebrally lacking in what one needs in order to perform the job. And, you know, Joe Biden just needs to have a great debate performance, you know, and one good debate performance on September 29th, you know, the first debate, I think will set aside the, you know, what I consider the mischaracterization of Joe Biden by the president, that, you know, the president's trying to drive home to American voters that, you know, the presidency's not in safe hands with Joe Biden. You know, so I think in terms of the policy issues, where the candidates stand, and the alignment of voters who care deeply about those issues, I think everything's set at this point. There's a relatively very small portion of the electorate that is a swing voter portion, and we've been talking about some of those today, of course, who I consider absolutely critical in this election cycle. So an enormous amount of money is going to be spent reaching out, I assume, to a relatively small segment of the electorate in several key states in the Electoral College.
Dr. Mark J. Rosell is Dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. His extensive published work at the intersection of religion and U.S. politics includes Catholics and U.S. politics after the 2016 elections, Understanding the Swing Vote, God at the Grassroots, 2016, The Christian Right in American Politics, Religion and the American Presidency, and the Oxford Encyclopedia of Politics and Religion. Mark, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us today, and we hope to talk with you again.
Well, thank you, Elton. I enjoyed the interview, and I'd be happy to come back.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, Rabbi Irwin Kula on New Beginnings, and later, Interfaith Alliance Policy Director Catherine Joseph. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. The Jewish New Year's celebration of Rosh Hashanah began Friday at sundown. Even as so many of us long for new beginnings, our series Healing of the Nation focuses on overcoming the threats many of us fear are coming after this November's election, regardless of who wins the vote. And knowing he can bring these two themes together as few others can, I spoke on Wednesday with Rabbi Irwin Kula, president of CLOW, the Institute for Jewish Learning and Leadership in New York City. I'm glad you're back on State of Belief Radio.
Glad to be here. You know, we surely need your voice at this moment, so I'm honored to be here like always.
We are seeing such distrust, dislike, and even hatred among Americans right now. Clearly, this has been encouraged for political advantage by some who hold positions of power and influence. But none of this is new, historically speaking. Irwin, how worried are you?
So I think, you know, like everybody, I get up in the morning sometimes and I'm like completely unnerved and at the craziness. And then I take a deep breath, and maybe it's because I'm a person of faith. I go, you know, the truth is there's always a dance between chaos and creation. You know, Scripture says, and I know I love to quote Scripture to you, right? Scripture says God doesn't create from nothing. There's tohu vavohu, this chaos, and the dance is chaos and order and chaos and creation. And in many ways, as chaotic as it feels, one, there's less chaos today than almost any time in human history. And America has known far worse chaos than this. And on the other hand, the chaos itself is grabbing our attention. There are more people in the streets. There are more people asking serious questions. By the way, from the streets all the way up to Jamie Dimon, at, you know, who's asking from the business roundtable, yikes, maybe shareholder capitalism is not all it's cracked up to be. So we're asking questions at a serious level in the culture that chaos and disorder forces upon us. And in that respect, then, this is a birth moment. And as a Jew, Rosh Hashanah, the birthday of the world, well, the birthday of the world, big bangs are explosive, you know? So we're living in explosive times. They're less explosive than many other times in American history. And if we can all, and that's everybody, all the way up and down and across the food chain, if everybody could take a deep breath and be a touch more curious about other people and their experiences, and a touch more sacrificial in what they contribute to people more vulnerable, we'll get through this. We will get through this. So fundamentally, I'm hopeful, even if there are mornings I wake up and I'm like completely unnerved.
Well, my friend, I'm not sure what's worse, the bigotry and bias or the utter denial that these dark forces are even at play in our society. Do you think the refusal to face our problems is more fear of facing the truth or some kind of tribal allegiance to alternative facts?
Look, I think there's a lot of reasons for where we are. And so I hate to reduce anything, but I would say, you know, Jews over the Rosh Hashanah blow the shofar. And the shofar says, wake up, wake up, wake up. Okay? So there are things we have to wake up to that we have all collectively denied. Okay? And my advice at the moment is the best thing, let's say, we can do, let's call us the liberals and the progressives, the people who have different sorts of education, the people who have gone, who had some psychological background. The best thing we can do is understand that there's always a dance between dark and light. And the most important thing is that dark and light are together in the same system, which means if we're picking up bigotry in the world, if we are picking up hate in the world, we have to take some responsibility for having contributed to the enabling conditions for that hate and bigotry to emerge, okay? Because either we're all in it together or we're not. And we're not allowed to be spiritual people that say, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, all is one, all is one. We're not allowed to be New Age people and say that the world is a seamless, interdependent reality and all is one. We're not allowed to be meditators and see the capaciousness and boundlessness of reality. We're not allowed to do that and then come back from those experiences and say, but I know exactly who they are, and they are the bad people. That is not the role of spiritual and religious people, and this doesn't mean roll over, and it doesn't mean accept the bigotry. But it means asking a question. If we're all in this together, and maybe we're not, let's be honest then we're not, but then we shouldn't use that slogan. If we are all in this together, and this is one interconnected system, then at least at the psychocultural level or the psychospiritual level, we have helped enable the very situation that we are in. That doesn't mean we're morally culpable, because a lot of it is unintended consequences. But that's the kinds of questions we are going to, this week, the liberal progressive we is going to need to ask. Because if we're as hawkish and we're as demonizing and we're as excluding as the side that we experience as bigoted and dark, then we are actually like them. But we may be at a higher level, but we're like them at a higher level. And that's not good, right? So we're going to have to figure out who we are in this drama of the larger we. And it can't just be us, them. Hmm. Right? Even if we're a better us, even if we're a better version us, right? All we'll do is we'll harden. And the last thing about that is there is no them. Right? 60 million people, right, are not a them. There's a lot of thems there. And some of those thems are in the us, much more than we would like to believe. So there's no them. That's what I think a Rosh Hashanah invitation is, because Rosh Hashanah is to take a cosmic perspective. And you'll appreciate this from a cosmic perspective, which means from God's perspective, from reality's perspective, from the universe's perspective. Justice and compassion are exactly the same thing. If I knew the full story of every human being, I would know exactly why they are behaving the way they are right now. And I would have tremendous compassion because I would understand them. And then I would try to figure out what has to be changed in the story that produces us. That's what we ask on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. That's what Jews ask of God. We look up and we say, hey, listen, you know what? You know our secrets. You know our innermost thoughts. You know everything, right? You know our insides of our insides. You know the stuff that we don't even know about ourselves in our unconscious and subconscious. And because you know us completely, and we still matter, and we're still wanted, and we're still loved, you will have compassion on us, which will be the most just thing to do. We have to operate that way relative to the people that we now experience as bigots and dark forces and primitive and all the things that they may actually be, but they're related to us. They are fellow human beings produced at that moment of creation.
Erwin, many people think it's inevitable that things will get worse before they get better. How can the Jewish teachings you study and promote help us prepare for that?
So one is to say birth pangs, right? Birth contractions are painful and birth is messy, okay? If we are true to our own teachings, and by the way, that's both our political teachings and our religious teachings, that we may well be at a sort of evolutionary leap moment. It's not surprising with technological advances and people rubbing up against each other in ways they never have and boundaries more permeable than ever before. It's not surprising that we are birthing and emerging some new ways of being together as human beings. That we all have to take a deep breath, and we have to be the best at staying calm. Okay, and that staying calm doesn't mean staying alert, it means super alert, right? Staying calm and not fanning the fire, right, of things are going to be, and it's apocalyptic. No apocalypse is here. This is the stages of development that human beings go through. Babies stumble and fall and hit themselves, and sometimes they cut themselves. Right? And teenagers get into car accidents because they don't have the same sort of impulse control. And there's a lot of things that happen as we grow, and that's the same with culture and history. So that's one. We actually have to have some stillness and calm and model that rather than become apocalyptic, because our apocalyptic thinking generates worse apocalyptic thinking on the other. And the second thing is, whoever we are in the drama, here's the Torah for the day. Here's the scripture for the day. There were two sages, Hillel and Shammai, in the first century, very turbulent times in Palestine, much like right our times, very turbulent, empires collapsing and empires growing. And Hillel and Shammai argued about every single thing, over 250 arguments in the Talmud. And the Talmud says they both have the words of the living God. And then the Talmud says, but the cases were decided according to Hillel's view. And so the Talmud asked, if both were the words of the living God, in other words, both sides were true, yes and no, and up and down, and permitted and prohibited. Why were the cases, why did the law, why did the way of the community move according to Hillel? And it says one simple thing, because Hillel taught Shammai's opinions before he taught his own. I think right now this is a really, really, really important thing. Right, left, red, blue, progressive, conservative, traditionalist, innovative, hopeful, fearful, right, more conventional, less conventional. What we have to do is to learn the best of the other side. Right now what we're doing is everyone is comparing their best to their worst. All right, I'm not interested in comparing, right, my Torah to Trump's Torah. Okay, he has a toxic personality, and we all know it, right? But I am interested in comparing my Torah and learning my Torah with the very, very best of conservative thinking, with the very, very, very best of traditionalist thinking, with the very, very best of the thinking that says there is a role for authority, there is a role for purity, there is a role for sin, there is a role for honor and integrity and respect and prudence and temperance. I'm interested in reading the best of the other side. And I don't want to teach my Torah until I read the best. Because when Hillel did that, two things happened. One, his own understanding of the other, who he deeply disagreed with, grew. Because he recognized it is not possible for another human being
to be 100% wrong. There is always some partial divine image and divine truth in the voice of another. If we shema, if we listen really, really, really carefully. And two, when we incorporate the best insights and the best truths of the other side, which can only happen when we read the best, internalize it, and can teach it, our truth grows. And that's the job, to seek constantly the elusive truth that will make this human drama better.
Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, is celebrated this weekend. Would you talk about the ceremonies connected to this celebration, what they mean, and are there safety restrictions connected to the pandemic that will affect the rituals that would normally take place?
So, like any public sorts of rituals and gatherings, the vast majority of synagogues are not having anything in person. Some are doing limited seating outside. Some are doing parking lots with limited seating. So all the normal precautions that, and probably a touch more precautions because we're a more older community, is happening, across the Jewish world. There's unbelievable creativity in Zoom services and producing different kinds of experiences people can stream. And so like in the church communities and other religious communities and in the entertainment world, there are many new ways of trying to offer and create a Rosh Hashanah experience for the community. In terms of, and I think in that respect, this is going to be a very interesting thing next Rosh Hashanah, when so much of how we learned about what's really important in Rosh Hashanah, what really is essential, which is one of the big questions. What's essential and non-essential is a really new question for us to be asking at this level. And I'm doing that just not only as metaphor, but real, from people to what we keep in a service when we're Zooming and streaming. Right, so that's one, that sort of creativity, and yes, observing all the appropriate rules of the pandemic. In terms of the symbols, there's really only one absolutely unique symbol and practice of Rosh Hashanah, because prayer is prayer, and gathering in synagogue is gathering in synagogue, and eating is eating, and blessing over the wine is blessing over the wine, and that is the blowing of the shofar. That's the ram's horn. That's the unique symbol. And interestingly enough, everyone's doing that. In fact, in New York City, they have gathered people who blow shofar, and they're going to be blowing shofar in the streets at different times, at 1:30 at 83rd Street, at 1:45 at 93rd Street. And so we're having shofar blowing all over the city, which is coming out of the synagogue and doing it in the streets, almost as if it's saying, awake, 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 wake up everybody from their slumber. We are in this together. There is promise and possibility in this moment. And let's stop denying stuff, and let's own up to how we can make this world better. Wake up, wake up, wake up. And that's happening, by the way. I know in Denver, there are shofar blowers in all the parks in Denver that are going to be blowing at different times. So I think this is a sort of remarkable, the symbol, the unique practice is now being offered out and brought into the world, which, of course, is a metaphor. If when we wake up, what we realize is the things that Scripture has said for a long time. Love the stranger, right? Because loving the stranger is actually loving that which is strange inside of you. And love your neighbor as yourself. But the fact is, we're learning that neighbor in 2020 has real different content than neighbor in the year 200. It's much wider. And so bringing the shofar out into the streets and blowing, and maybe this is the last insight, is the blows of the shofar go along, goes whole, brokenness, more brokenness, whole. Whole, brokenness, more brokenness, whole. Whole, brokenness, more brokenness, and then there's a long blow, da-da. And it seems to me that's the reality of the human drama. There's wholeness, and there's brokenness, and there's more brokenness, and then there's wholeness, and brokenness, and more brokenness. And that is the drama. And if we can understand, maybe now we're in a broken moment, then if we work hard and look around the corner, there's potential new levels of wholeness. And I think that's the deepest sort of religious truth, and I'd like to suggest the cosmic truth, too.
So, Irwin, in a moment like this, from where can we draw hope?
Oh, my gosh. I'll start first. in February, I became a grandfather. Okay, so this is where, you know, I'm 62 years old, and 1 month before the pandemic, my daughter gave birth, and it was not easy. It took longer, and it was more complicated for her to get birth, as for many people these days. And I have this beautiful grandchild. So one, we get hope, and I think Christians understand this best because they understood the birth of a child in a, I would say, a very deep and profound way. I would look around at the children who are in the street, the children who are in our home, and I know it's hard these days to parent without schools, but look at our children. Look at the purity of those children. Look at the hopefulness of those children. Look at how those children don't hate. Look at how those children simply want to be loved. They want to count. They want to matter. They want to be held accountable also because that's how they know they count. So one, first, let's look at our children. Look at the children. No wonder our scripture is saying they're all children of God. There's something profoundly hopeful, children. I look at my grandchild and I say, yikes. Oh, my God, God willing, my child will live 80, 90, 100 years. I live into the 22nd century. So that's one, two. Second is we can look at the heroes around us, the level of sacrifice that we have seen over the last 6 months, right? The level from health workers to delivery people to cashiers to truck drivers to the people who've kept the lights on in our city and cleaned the shit from our sewers. Those people, right, are the heroes because every single one of them put their life in danger. While people like me and many of the people listening on this show and many liberal progressives have been able to work remotely and work fine as our pensions went up, et cetera, et cetera. So let's look at the heroes and be inspired by the sacrifice. And finally, to look at our scriptural stories. Moses dies on the top of a mountain looking in. Is he a failure or a success? His whole dream to get into land. And he doesn't get in. Success or failure? The real success is to be able to look from the mountaintop and get glimpses of where the world could look. Not to get there, because if you get there, you're probably a bad person with a small vision, right? You don't get there. What you do is you look in, you get glimpses, you take a deep breath, and you say, wow, what a gift it is to simply be here in life.
Rabbi Irwin Kula is longtime president of CLOUD, the Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership in New York City, a good friend. Rabbi Kula is the author of the book Yearnings, Embracing the Sacred Messiness of Life. Irwin, thank you so much for taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio again, and Shana Tova.
Thank you so much. It's always about a pleasure to hear your voice. I always feel calm about your voice. And blessings to everybody, and it should be a good year for us all.
In January 2014, my wife and I moved into the Denver Catholic Worker House. The Catholic Worker movement started really out of a sense of taking personal responsibility to care for our neighbors. On the front porch of Denver, I saw firsthand the suffering of homelessness. I saw the way that large social systemic issues were affecting my neighbors. As a person of faith, I felt drawn in to try to become a part of a solution to this massive homelessness crisis. That led to creating Denver's first two tiny home villages. We founded an organization with nothing but a strong desire to be a part of a more human-centric solution than what was being offered.
In an election year like no other, we're called upon to act. People of faith and faith values don't belong to any one party or politician. This year, I'm voting for housing and economic justice. Your vote, your values.
The language of values in culture and in politics has been assumed by the political right. And for too long, the rest of us have let them get away with it. This year, that's changing with many leaders and groups stepping up to say that values of inclusion, mercy, and respect are core to their identities as people of faith or of no faith. Working to amplify the message that core values should inspire ballot box choices for all voters is Interfaith Alliance, with its Your Vote, Your Values campaign, And with an update, I'm happy to be joined by Alliance Director of Policy and Advocacy, Catherine Joseph. Katie, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Walden. Great to be with you.
So what's the Your Vote, Your Values campaign all about?
Well, I think as we're heading into what is, without question, one of the most highly contested elections, certainly in my lifetime, there's a real question at the forefront of many voters' minds, across the political spectrum and across the religious spectrum as well, about what kind of future we want to build. You know, voting is one of the most concrete, direct ways that we as citizens can have our voices heard in the policies that our government will enact in future years. And so across the country, people are asking really challenging questions as they're looking at the candidates for office, the hyper-partisanship that we're seeing, and asking themselves, what do I believe? What do I want the future to look like for myself, for my community, for my children, for future generations? And so this campaign is highlighting exactly what those kind of internal interrogations and community activism may be looking like for individual leaders, advocates, clergy members, people of faith, who are making that change in their community today, talking about what their faith values are, how that animates how they move through the world, and calling on their fellow voters to do the same this year.
Talk a little more about the messages that you're trying to amplify with this campaign.
So often we get deep into the weeds on partisan policy questions, supporting the actions of an administration or the actions of a federal agency, but we don't ask ourselves why. What are we looking to accomplish? What are we looking to achieve? And so with the Your Vote, Your Values campaign, each of our storytellers talks about one particular value that's driving their vote this year, whether that is economic justice, strong public schools, access to comprehensive health care in a moment when health care is so critically important to our well-being as a nation. These are tough conversations that folks are having, but they're really essential conversations to get us out of the partisan back and forth and get us looking forward and thinking more concretely about what we want this country to look like.
Can you give us an example of one of the messages that you've heard?
Sure. So just this week, our featured video highlights the work of Cole Chandler, who is the executive director of the Colorado Village Collaborative. And Cole tells his story about being a resident of a Catholic social justice house and engaging with members of his community who were facing very directly the consequences of housing policies that were driving many low-income folks from their homes and facing homelessness. And he talks about his experience and investment, his calling, as he puts it, as a person of faith, to be involved in a more human-centered solution to these housing crisis problems. And he explains why this year he is voting for housing and economic justice. And his story is not unique. So many of us are grappling with the economic fallout of the current pandemic. And in our best moments, I think we are all called to action to make some change.
So, Katie, where are our listeners, where are voters likely to encounter the Your Vote, Your Values campaign?
Well, I would invite listeners to go to interfaithalliance.org to watch the featured video that highlights Cole's work in Denver, Colorado this week. Those videos will be running on Facebook and available on our Twitter as well. And in future weeks between now and the election, we'll be highlighting a different storyteller focused on a different value, moral calling, and ultimately a call to action.
My guess is that you want people not only to hear those messages, you want them to share these messages in a viral way. Is that correct?
Yes. I strongly encourage all of our listeners and members of our communities to share these videos and to be invited, encouraged to do some of that moral searching. I invite folks to share what their vote and their values mm-hmm. are this year as we think through what it means to vote in favor of justice.
Katie, I know you spend a lot of time on policy and advocacy, even in these times of working from home for most of us. Do you find that the political campaign is built more on personalities and simplistic themes, increasingly disconnected from the actual work of governing? And is that one of the trends your vote, your values is intended to help reverse?
It's interesting, I will say, being based in Washington, D.C., I'm in some ways very much aware of the industry around political messaging, choosing the right words that will resonate with the right voters to achieve a particular outcome. But I think you're right that in some ways that detracts from the underlying values, what drives a particular candidate to seek higher office, what it means to actually improve the experience, the well-being, the outcomes of the communities that they seek to serve. And so while so many of us, whether we like it or not, get caught up in the back and forth news stories of who said what today, the Your Vote, Your Values campaign encourages us to dig a little bit deeper, to think past some of this messaging and ask ourselves really critical questions as voters about which candidates, which policies actually embody the values that we are seeking to advance through civic engagement.
Catherine Joseph is Director of Policy and Advocacy at Interfaith Alliance, working to preserve true religious freedom for all. Katie, thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilton.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people to conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Wilton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.